Let me begin with just a general survey of art. What is art? How should the Catholic relate to art? Let me say, the Church has always had a kind of uneasy connection with the artist. And that is appropriate. That is absolutely appropriate. Part of it comes from a long philosophical tradition. If we go back to the Greeks, we can find, for example, in Plato, when Plato builds his republic, he wants to keep the poet out of the republic. Plato is very suspicious of art and what art can do, and therefore when he builds this, is attempting to build this ideal world, he doesn't necessarily want the poet in it. We can find in St. Augustine warnings about the theater. And the Church has always had a particularly uncomfortable relationship with the theater. It's appropriate. Playhouses in and of themselves are not exactly located in the best parts of town. Those who hang about there are not necessarily the highest or most moral people in any given society. And the whole notion of imitation has always been questionable. The Church has always examined that question. What does it mean to take on another persona? God gave you one personality. Is there something, and St. Augustine goes into this, is there something odd in assuming another persona? I'm dealing particularly with theater here in one sense, but this could be extended to some degree. Now, at the same time, the Church has been fully aware of the power of art and how art has been able to advance the faith. So that during the Middle Ages, we find the Church becoming the place, in fact, where that great legacy of medieval drama that was then passed on to the Renaissance actually blooms out of. We trace back the very first English play to a tiny little trope that was performed in the Easter Mass, the Quem Quaeritas trope, where some priest appear before the altar and ask the question, where is he? And another priest playing the angel said, he is not here, he is risen. It's actually acted out. And we have that, we know that, and in fact we know, and out of that slowly grew, you know, the next thing you know, you have Hamlet. And that seems crazy, but we can actually trace the development of the theater in England from that tiny little moment in the Mass. The Church was supportive. We have records and accounts of small plays being done in the Church, always for the purpose, and I'll get into this later, one of the main purposes of art, which is to educate. Art is a principal means of educating the faithful, and can be a very effective means of educating the faithful. And as a result, the Church was highly supportive until, of course, the plays began to get a little too complex. They began to lapse over into that other purpose of art, and it's a valid purpose, which is entertainment. But the Church, in its wisdom, when entertainment began to encroach on educational value, said, well, it's time to move out onto the steps. It's no longer appropriate to have some of these things going on in the sanctuary. Great wisdom, great prudence. And so the plays went to the Church steps, and soon were put on pageant wagons. I'll talk about that in a moment. And soon there were permanently built playhouses, and the tradition was there. But we can trace it back to the Church. So that the Church has always had a sense that art can be used to a greater good, but also aware that there is a tendency then for art to become autonomous, for the artist to take over. And at that point, it is not appropriate necessarily that there be a link. But I would add that the Church was always there overseeing what went on in the theater. There were huge battles in Shakespeare's own day. I'll mention this. I'll get into it a bit more specifically later, but religious battles over the nature of the theater. The Puritans wanted to close the playhouses down. The Puritans hated the theater. We find again that it was the Church who tended to be supportive in the battle with the Puritans. Not that all play acting should be abolished, but that it should be watched carefully, that it could be a good. And again, what we find here, and it's so typical of Catholic thought, is a sensible balance. is a sensible balance, a wariness, and an appropriate wariness, but also an understanding of a possible great good that can come out of this. So, church has had this uneasy connection with art. Let me give one other quick example from our own time. There can be little doubt, I think, that the medium for our time, the great entertainment medium, has been the cinema in this century, overpowering in its influence. We don't yet fully know what effect the cinema has had. Something I've been thinking about lately, and may do a conference on later here. It's very difficult to get the core of this healthy or unhealthy alliance between art and technology. Cinema at its best is a second-rate art. I'll defend that at some other time. But it is the medium, it is the artistic medium I know that I grew up with at least twice a week. Saturday afternoons, going to the movies with my friends and seeing the serial and the comedy and the coming attraction and, you know, the newsreel and then a John Wayne Western. And then also at some point during the week going with my family and seeing the new films that were coming out. And I saw many of the great Hitchcock classics, the John Ford films, when they were first released. They had their effect, a very important effect. But what the Hollywood movie industry was always aware of was the index. I didn't even know of it at the time. I'd vaguely heard of it. But the Catholic Church rated films. And they told Catholics which films were appropriate and which films were not. And Hollywood paid close attention to that index. And what we have again is that notion that Mother Church in her wisdom can take and I think it is in some ways a questionable medium, but say there is a possibility, there is a potential for good here, but we will monitor it. And we will tell the faithful what is appropriate and inappropriate. And if there is something genuinely inappropriate, we will tell the faithful not to attend. And Hollywood paid close attention because at that time, if Mother Church said to the faithful, you do not attend that film, whoa, the bucks that were lost. And therefore, they were not likely to finance a film that would be questionable with the chance of the church saying, don't you attend, and losing those revenues. That may be pragmatic. But it was a way in which the church kept Hollywood at least decent. We can go back to a time as recent as the 1950s when there was an enormous controversy because the word virgin was used in a film. A source of huge controversy that the word itself, the idea, would be brought into a film. When the index disappeared, one of the results of the council, not only did corruption fill the screen, but the quality of filmmaking declined. And the reason was the Catholic Church, in riding shotgun on Hollywood, forced those artists to be more clever, more creative, more imaginative, and intellectually honest. So that even in our own time, we can see, and again, what I would call a kind of uneasy tension between the church and art. Not fully approving necessarily, being there to censure, being there to judge, but at the same time, in doing so, helping the artists and whatever that industry is, and art is almost always a business of some kind, helping that industry to perform at its highest level. Now, where does all this come from? Let me go all the way back to Genesis 1. And talk about something that's you know about and that is very obvious. I quote Genesis 1:26. God says, "Let us make man to our image and likeness." And of course, you know that has to do with certain properties of soul in which man has been granted by God certain capacities that define God himself, that bond between God and man which is unique. But if you look at that scripture verse in and of itself, one of those properties is named in the verse. Let us make man. And we see God the Creator, God the Maker, making man in his image, and therefore I would say one of those aspects, one of those images, one of those likenesses that appears in man is a desire to make things. I would say that the creative urge, and it's there, the creative urge in mankind comes to a degree from being made in the image and likeness of God. And therefore, man is possessed of a desire and a need to make things. Always has been. Now, we can rank that making, because all making is not alike. There are those things that man makes out of necessity, simply out of necessity. If you were born an Eskimo in Alaska, you would need to make an igloo. You would need to slaughter a seal and make clothing to wear. So on one level, sort of on the lowest level, man's desire and need to make is a gift because man needs to make in order to survive. Just on a day-to-day level. Or we can think on the highest end when God orders Noah to build the ark. Noah, build the ark. And again, it's a matter of necessity and survival. In this case, a command from God. And Noah is given very specific dimensions, very specific orders about what that making will be. There are times like that when the request seems to be direct, absolutely direct, for the survival of the human race, that the human race may continue, and other times when we simply need to build a shelter, make clothing for ourselves, level of necessity. There's the level then, one above that, of crafting. We have a measure of human dignity, and while it may be necessary for us to eat, we somehow know that it's not appropriate that we make our meal and just toss it on the floor the way that a family pet will be glut. Whatever it gets, wherever it gets it, the animal will devour it, because it's food, it's there, it's good, the animal's operating on instinct. Well, man is above that. Man, again, has some measure of dignity, and therefore, we will eat together at a table. Now, the table can be cobbled together very quickly. You can run out in the woods in the space of about 20 minutes, put together something that is table-like that you can sit at, so you're not devouring your food off the floor. Or, on the other end of craftsmanship, those gorgeous tables that have been handed down from generation to generation, of century to century, where a great craftsman took the best possible materials, studied, built, crafted, shaped, ornamented, and you have a table that is beautiful in its own right. And the table, in some sense, defines the meal. There are certain kinds of meals you would not necessarily eat at that table. That is craftsmanship. That is a part of human nature. That is part of the dignity of man. Trying not just to make something because it's necessary, but to make something beautiful. Because the very act of crafting is in us, and we can rise to our best in making beautiful objects. Now, out of that can come something that is a danger. And that is making things selfishly for ourselves. Best example of that. Moses is up on the mountain, and Aaron tells the people to gather the gold together and make the golden calf. It is making. There can be little doubt that golden calf was a beautiful object. But there is, and this is again, I would say, one of the reasons why Mother Church has always been careful about those who make, those who craft, those who create beautiful things. It is possible to make beautiful things and at the same time come to forget the ultimate end, the ultimate maker, the ultimate creator. And we have a clear example of it there. It is interesting that shortly before that in Exodus, we have we have God saying, make an altar of earth unto me. Simple substance, the dirt of the earth, build an altar up from that. And then we have the notion of making this gorgeous object, this calf, out of gold that will be worshipped. And it is very possible that the ends of making, the end of making, can somehow be turned to a bad end. That is always there as a danger. How do we know them? How can we tell? What is the distinction? Well, I would say the distinction is ultimately who or what is being worshipped. And I would say that any act of creation, given the fact that the impulse to create is something given to us by God, and in some ways a kind of reflection of a God-like property, therefore the end of any act of creation should ultimately be worship. The act of creating should not be done for itself or for the artist, but somehow in recognition of the ultimate maker, the ultimate creator, that is God. It is for that reason that it is not accidental that the greatest art has always been connected with worship. We can go back to the Greeks, for example, and find that even there, the greatest things that they created, whether it be the Parthenon that sits on the Acropolis in Athens, or Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, grow out of their desire to worship. They did not, at that point, properly know what to worship, but out of that desire to worship, they made their most beautiful things out of that impulse to worship. So the creation of art and worship connected again. I say this to my students, I can prove it, it's right there. I mentioned earlier how the great tradition of medieval drama and the drama that follows it in England, France, and Spain grows out of the Mass. So that the impulse to create at that moment was connected with the impulse to worship. The two were one. We can expand that. The glory, the first glories of Western Europe that remain for us are those enormous cathedrals. They are studied as great works of architecture and art. They were places of worship. And it was the place of worship itself, quite apart from any artist or architect. We don't know who designed them. They're not signed in the way that the great medieval dramas are all anonymous. We don't know who wrote them. The artist had not yet intruded himself into the art-making process. We go back to the glorious music, that tradition of Western music. We had very little from Greece, from Rome. Where does our understanding of music begin? It begins with church music. It begins with the chant. And we can't necessarily say who wrote a good bit of it. Again, what we have is the beautiful, created work of art. We don't know necessarily who the artist was, but what began that long tradition of Western music was worship. That music comes out of the Mass. So that if you look at the great Western tradition, literature, specifically the drama, art, music, it grows out of worship. And to this day, the greatest art still reaches in that direction. In many ways, art has been secularized, but the greatest art is still somehow connected with worship in that the greatest artists are always putting God above their own self as artist, and the work of art should always somehow stretch toward God and attempt to give people a better understanding of God. And if it is done well, it will partake of God's goodness and truth. And if it is done with appropriate means, it will be a beautiful object. It's for that reason that you can look at one of the giants of our own century. I gave a talk here about a year ago on Evelyn Waugh's The Loved One, a wicked little book. Nasty, satirical, bitter, angry little book. It is a great work of art. It is a Catholic work of art. It is a Catholic artist wrestling with the madness of the world in which he finds himself. And to read that book intelligently and thoughtfully is to indeed move toward a better understanding of what is happening and come to understand more fully what man should be doing, what the relationship between life and death is, and what God requires of us. It's an extraordinary... It is not typical. And I'll come later to talk about the problem of the artist in a given age when the age itself is not Catholic. What does the artist do? The Catholic artist must put forward Catholic truth. But a great artist need not be Catholic to put forward that truth. Here is a cruel irony, and one thing that is essential in understanding the nature of art, and one reason why the church, again, is uncomfortable with art, and appropriately so. I find very often in speaking to traditional groups, if I recommend a book, you should read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The response will be, is he Catholic? And I have to say, no, he's not. And then I get this look like, you're asking me to read a book by someone who is not Catholic? And I have to go into an explanation. Not all great artists were Catholic. That does not mean God did not give talent to, allow that individual to use that talent for the greater glory of God. In the same way, it is possible for a good, devout Catholic to work long and hard at a work of art and have it be something that should not be put forward before the public, even if it is so packed with piety the pages shine. This actually happened, and a young man whom I had met just briefly, who had worked 10 years on a poem, 10 years on a poem, and brought it to me, handed and asked me to comment on it. Good Catholic man. Every single thing in the poem was good, solid Catholic doctrine. It was dreadful. Just dreadful. Not because his intentions were not the best, not because what he had to say was not good. He had no talent to say it. And it is very painful to have to say, well, I honor your intentions, but there are problems here, and here are the problems. And attempt to go through and begin, when the real problem is, God gave many gifts to that man, but the talent to write was not one of them. This is not a judgment. This is not a judgment. I could spend the next 10 years attempting to learn to tap dance. At the end of that 10 years, if I put on the taps and went out on a stage, I would make a fool of myself. Because I was not given the ability in my legs to move my feet and get this big lug of a body around it, much less tap at the same time. It's simply, I was not given that. And I could say, but I'd be a good Catholic tap dancer. It wouldn't matter. God, in his wisdom, chose not to give me any talent whatsoever in that direction, but God, in his great mercy, gave me some other gifts. My job is to develop those gifts. And again, this comes down to discerning what it is we are supposed to do in this world, and that is a very, very difficult thing to do. At the same time, God gave talent elsewhere. So that, and I was one of the great artists of the century is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who has much to tell us about suffering and the nature of suffering, the necessity of suffering. And though he is, he may be an Orthodox Christian in Russia, his message is one that must be heard. And what he has to say must be heard. And he has written magnificent works of art that should not be rejected because they're not Catholic. Along this line, I'll just wrap this up, this whole section up briefly, but along the same line, I was just reading a comment. The problem of the artist in the modern world, the artist has a couple of jobs. One is to tell the truth and to reflect the age in which the artist finds himself. This is very difficult if you're born into this world. How are you going to make beautiful things when this is the world you're living in? I was reading a little essay by one of my favorite artists, great artist, Catholic artist, Flannery O'Connor, the Southern short story writer. And she was commenting that she had received a letter from a pious Catholic lady who said, "I detest your work. At the end of the day, I sit down and read one of your stories, and it does not lift up my heart. I find it just foul and offensive." And O'Connor shot back a letter saying, My dear ma'am, I'm very sorry you don't like my work, but if you were reading it properly, it would lift up your heart. The problem is not in my story, but in your understanding. And then, you know, I tried to give some sense of what was going on, why it was written that way, what the purpose behind it was. And then O'Connor, who's telling about this exchange, says, You give me one such woman, and you have a woman who can't read. You give me 25,000 such women, and you have a book club. I don't know if you're aware right now, but this woman on television named Oprah, who is this very popular talk show, has started Oprah's book club. And once a month, she brings an author on and tells the audience to read this book. Well, suddenly, an individual book is selling 8 million copies across. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The problem is the books she's telling them to read are just awful. Just awful. Dreadful stuff. And the complete detachment of any sense at all of quality, any sense of what is good. There are more people writing right now than probably ever before. I would say there's less talent. It's just odd. It doesn't seem to be out there. It's not being trained properly. Again, a wonderful O'Connor line. Someone said, you know, the universities just aren't there doing their job teaching those of us who want to be creative writers to write. And O'Connor's response was, "Well, I don't think they're turning out too few of you. I think they're turning out too many of you. They're not doing their job. They should be stopping more of you." a good Catholic sense uttering hard truths. But the point finally, how do we know what's good? How can we know what's good? Well, certain things. I go back to the two principal things that great art, that any art should do. Number one, it should instruct. It must teach. Great art must teach. It must have something to say. And therefore, what it has to say must be true. Now, how it says it and what it says can be as diverse as human nature and human experience itself. There is a wide latitude there. And we do not learn just from the lives of the saints. There are many, many other kinds of human experience out there in the world that we can learn from. The other essential function of the artist is to delight. There has to be an entertainment value of some kind. St. Thomas says that the mind needs refreshment and recreation just as the body does. We cannot all the time be in deep study. It is natural in us to desire entertainment of a kind. We want to be delighted. Now, with those two ends, you have a spectrum. And some things, some works can move much more towards just entertaining and delighting. One thing I know for certain I will do when I'm with my three-year-old nephew, because we've done it before and we'll do it again, is I will sit down with his video machine and the TV and we will watch Pinocchio together. I am a big fan of the very early Disney cartoons. Snow White, Pinocchio, Bambi, Dumbo. That's about, you know, the very early ones. And I think Pinocchio is one of the greatest things ever created by man. And I can sit and take real joy and delight in it, as can my three-year-old nephew. The old Italian fairy tale, beautifully drawn and illustrated, loaded with the sort of basic, simple, honest human truths that I'm delighted to see going into my three-year-old nephew, while I can delight in the greatest animation ever done. Those scenes under the sea are with the whale are just, and of course we get into the iconography of being swallowed by the whale and surviving, and I know that three-year-old is getting lessons implanted in him that at some time will come back. Okay, that is glorious stuff. For me, that's on the entertainment and delight end of things. I don't have to study Pinocchio anymore. Pinocchio doesn't have a lot to instruct me with, but I can still delight in it. It's instructional for my three-year-old nephew. But I can teach King Lear for the 100th time and still be instructed. And that doesn't mean that when I go to see a production of King Lear, I am not still delighted by it or entertained, not in the same way. It's a different kind of entertainment, but it is still watching that passage of events and characters with the complexity of lived life that is simply extraordinary. Now, some works of art, as they instruct us, do so directly. Very clear what they're talking about, all right? There are other works of art that in which one can study, search for a lifetime, and come closer to the heart of it, but never fully understand it. Hamlet speaks to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and says, "What, would you pluck out the heart of my mystery?" And for centuries now, people have been trying to pluck out the heart of Hamlet's mystery, and it's unyielding. It's as mysterious as human nature itself. And yet, the more you study it, there's certain things you can learn about it. I know, given the group I'm speaking to, that I can use, I can bring up this gospel passage. You'll know what I'm talking about. It was last Sunday's gospel. Christ speaks the parable of the sower of the seeds to his disciples. And when he finishes it, the disciples say, "What was that about? What was that about?" And our Lord says, "You know, I'll tell you, I'll explain it to you. But I speak in parables so that those who can hear, let them hear; those that can see, let them see. Those out in the world, those souls out in the world may have to study my words to figure out what they need." God, in one sense, is direct and open. In another sense, God is hidden. Our Lord came and didn't just... Our Lord gives only one or two sermons in the Gospels. But look at all the parables. Look at all those stories he tells. Now, would God come to teach us, to instruct us in stories, if he had not put within man a desire to hear stories, appreciate stories, and understand stories? Stories. Those parables are little works of art. Those stories are there for us to know how God intends us to live, what our end is, what we need to know, and yet they are in story form. And our Lord himself says it's not always clear. It's not always clear. But what is clear, those who have ears will hear. Those who have eyes will see. But it's not necessarily going to be easy. I see this every time. I'm speaking now on just a secular level. I see this all the time. I'll say to the class, go read King Lear, and we'll begin discussing it on Thursday. They come back into the classroom, And before I begin, the voice will ring out from somewhere in the back of the class, "Boy, that was boring." And my response is always the same. Art is a great mirror. You see reflected what you put into it. King Lear isn't boring. You are boring. Just shuts him up cold. At the same time, in the same group, you will see one or two who have been there who have suddenly been grabbed by this. Wasn't boring for them. Suddenly their lives changed and they're loaded with questions. Why does this happen? What does this mean? How can this go on? And you know they run off to read it again. That's just, you know, that's me as literature professor, but it means I fully understand that notion of those who have ears, let them hear. It's there. It's given out. But to confront a great work of art means you may have to commit to it. It may take some work. It may still delight. But if it's going to instruct, it will make certain claims on your time. It's why it is possible to spend one's life with one great work of art, and that can be sufficient. I had a friend in high school whose father, who was a factory worker, who built tires for 40-some years, all he did, every day went to the factory, unendurable existence, got paid well, would come home, watch the TV, but once a year read one book, David Copperfield, which I'll speak of later. It's one of my favorite books. I said to him once, "You know, Dickens wrote a lot of other very good novels." He said, "I know, but I like this one." And every year he'd read David Copperfield again. That was not wasted time. And he knew that book. There's no getting around it. He knew everything in that book. That was time well spent. That was time well spent. And there were clearly lessons he had taken from it. It's fascinating. It's mysterious. And one other thing, and I'll wrap this section of the talk up with this. If we come to a work that is as complex and interesting as life itself, Shakespeare in Hamlet says the artist's job is to hold the mirror up to nature. The best artists will reflect what's going on in life, but so that we can comprehend it, they will structure and order it for us. It won't just be this enormous, complex collection of people and events that overwhelm us. In order to understand it, the artist will hold the mirror up to nature, give us some sense of what life is like and about, but order it so we have something comprehensible with which we can study this mysterious thing called life. Now, if we sit and watch something that's just sheer delight and entertainment, we don't need to be instructed. I'll take something even sillier than Pinocchio. Not that Pinocchio is silly. A Roadrunner cartoon, okay? The coyote and the roadrunner, all they do is chase, the coyote chases the roadrunner and never succeeds, and the boulders drop on his head, and he builds a bomb and it blows him up. The amount of instruction in there is minimal, teeny tiny, almost nothing at all. The amount of delight is overwhelming. It is, for some reason, it's always funny to watch the coyote blow up again. I mean, it's just, you know, and yet he goes back. And yet every time he goes back to the Acme chemical company and buys from the same people, none of their stuff ever worked. This is just delight. There is very little of any value there, but there is delight there, okay? But the mind can be refreshed and entertained. You don't need anyone to lead you through a Roadrunner cartoon. You don't finish seeing a Roadrunner cartoon and seek out someone in the world who will explain it to you. You don't have to do that, okay? That is not necessary. But you can finish seeing a production of Hamlet, or you can finish reading Moby Dick and say, "Wow, that was incredible. I wonder what that was all about." And if you have been given a humble heart and genuine intellectual curiosity, you'll want to know. Now you can read it again and that will help. But what you really want is someone who will guide you through it. As Virgil guides Dante, through the Inferno and up Mount Purgatory. We need guides who can explain things to us. And again, one of the purposes of great art is that it forces us to submit to authority. The authority of the artist and the authority of a guide who can help us through it. So in the process of humbling ourselves, having been, even if we were delighted by a production of Hamlet or enjoyed reading Moby Dick, we now long to be instructed. I do not take any pride in the fact that students line up to take my courses. I'm delighted in it. I'm proud. In one sense, I'm proud they want to read Shakespeare, that they know that I can give Shakespeare to them. Okay? But the fact of the matter is, all I am doing, the reason the line is at the door trying to get into my Shakespeare course, is they know I'll tell them something. Word is out, this guy has something to say. And you, as Catholic priests, know full well what it is I have to tell them. It's Catholic truth. And when they hear a word of truth, something happens. And when I can take much ado about nothing and lay it out before them, I don't have to tell them it's Catholic truth. I just tell them it's true. By virtue of being true, it's Catholic. And they know they've heard something that's accurate. And the ones that want to learn more wander up to my office. That's why I keep the door open and the old Catholic encyclopedia on the shelf. I won't use the word in class unless I'm asked, and then I will, but the minute God's grace has led them up the stairs and they've come in to sit down because they want to talk, all they have to do is turn their head to the bookshelf and bam, there it is. So I don't even have to bring it up. At some point they'll say, are you Catholic? No, I just keep those books here because they're colorful. But then it comes up. They want to know. They want to be guided. They want to be told. And again, what do we have here? We have something that is Catholic. Submitting to authority. And I do know a little something about literature because I, God be praised, was well taught. I had a miserable education, but I happened to have 3 or 4 professors of literature who taught me how to read. I put that down to God's grace, meaning I was supposed to do something with it. So that the very act, it is the disciple saying to Christ, what's that story mean? Wanting, needing, through the grace of God, to understand what's in that story. For them, the salvation of souls depended on what they would learn. That is not necessarily all the case with the students I deal with, although the salvation of each individual soul could depend on hearing the truth and learning the truth. The next question, I've laid a lot of groundwork there. The next question, and I will get to this tonight, why Shakespeare? Why this man? Okay? Out of all of those figures out there to study, why this one in particular? What does he have to say? Was he Catholic? I'll address that tonight. And in fact, that is an overwhelming question. I'll give you an answer to that. This is a good stopping place. I've talked enough. And we can all go have another cup of coffee. Thank you. I'll see you tonight. Oh, certainly. I'm more than happy to take questions. Yes.
I was talking this morning about friends studying literature at the university. The question he asked me is Shakespeare the author or is there another author?
Let me tell you, that is one of the first questions I get when I begin a course. Did this guy really write these plays? I'll give you a simple answer explanation. Yes, he wrote those plays. One of the gravest injustices ever done to any artist is this nonsense that's out there claiming that someone other than this man, William Shakespeare, actually wrote all these works. It is a curious thing. I would say this, that for me, that's a sign. That kind of persecution, well, that guy didn't really write the works. Wouldn't happen to just anybody. Nobody's out there claiming that Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison, whose books are studied in the Oprah Book Club, who never wrote a page of prose that any mind can make its way through, and is the woman who claimed that Bill Clinton is our first black president. No one ever claimed she didn't write her works. We know she wrote the works. No one will ever claim that someone else wrote the works. This began in the late 18th century. Shakespeare dies in 1616. Through his whole lifetime, he was who he was. Everyone knew who he was. We have, in fact, not a lot of information, but a good bit of documentary evidence. We can piece together the life. I'll do that tonight. There's some gaps in it. When he died, he was honored by his friends. He was a very humble man. He never saw his own works collected. Had it not been for the actors in his company and friends, this book would be about a third of its length. His friends put this together. He never bothered having his works collected. No one ever questioned the legitimacy of authorship until the latter part of the 18th century. And where did it spring up? In America. First off, we have jealousy. Just a bit of jealousy. Second of all, where does it spring up? It springs up in the upper class circles. Snobbery. No young person with an eighth grade education from the middle classes in England at that time could have possibly written these works. And therefore, if you look at the candidates, and now there's a whole host, from Francis Bacon to Christopher Marlowe to the Earl of Oxford to Queen Elizabeth herself, they keep coming up with new candidates. Every one of them from the upper classes. They never claim, no, it was actually Joe the bartender who wrote these plays. It's never anyone below Shakespeare's social rank. It's always someone above it. Part of it is snobbery. Just sheer snobbery. No one with an eighth grade education from Stratford who, as Ben Jonson says, who had small Latin and less Greek, could possibly have written these plays. Well, those of us as Catholics know how God distributes his talents. They can show up in the most unlikely places. Even this young lad from a small town with an eighth grade. But I also then say, and this is absolutely true, an eighth grade education in Little Stratford, 1,500 inhabitants, was much better than the education I got, and I carry around a PhD and people think I know something. Nonsense. I would have preferred the eighth grade Stratford education. I have no Greek. My Latin's pathetic. I was trained not at all in the Catholic faith. I got none of that. I learned virtually nothing about history. Shakespeare in the eighth grade, when he stopped school, had a much better education than I had with my PhD. That's a fact. So it's snobbery. It's resentment. And just sheer contrariness. And if you look at the people who have taken up this cause, Freud was an anti-Stratfordian, okay? A crazy woman named Delia Bacon, crazy woman, who got a number, and this was in the early 19th century, who got a number of other leading lights to go along with it. She convinced a whole slew of people. She apparently was very, very persuasive. And of course, her candidate was Francis Bacon. Delia Bacon, Francis Bacon. I don't even have to explain that one. But she was so nuts, she actually went over to Stratford and broke into the little church where Shakespeare is buried with a pickaxe and a shovel and a lantern and was going to dig him up. Somehow to prove that, I don't know what she was going to prove, but they... reason being, the grave is undisturbed, and it's on the gravestone. We don't know if Shakespeare wrote it. I suspect he did. The following lines: "Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust, enclose it here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, but cursed be he who moves my bones." And as a result, the grave has never been touched, never been opened. Delia tried to get in there, but she was stopped. Lessons that you can learn from the study of a particular great artist. What I'm going to do is advance Shakespeare. I'll mention Dante briefly tonight. But the fact of the matter is, given the little amount of time, and that's just a given, given the small amount of time, then if you have a little bit of time, where can you use it most valuably? Curiously, and I say this to you priests, I would not say you should sit down with Waugh's Helena. It's a great book. I recommend it. If you have the time, read it. I say you sit down with a loved one or Bride's Head Revisited. That's what's going on out there, and you need to know it. And you have a Catholic artist of great insight who can explain things to you that you are going to run up against, because the great artist is giving you a vision of that world. It's what I said earlier. The artist holds the mirror up to nature and can help you. It may not be moral and theology as such, but if it's a Catholic writer, you're getting Catholic sense, and you're getting it particularized in ways that could be completely unexpected to you. You have to occasionally just run bang into things where you're just going, what is happening here? What is going on here? And given what's going on out there, that's going to happen more and more. And I do think that the best Catholic art, or the best art, I go back to Solzhenitsyn, not Catholic, but I would give Solzhenitsyn to almost any serious reader before I would give most other writers of the century. In fact, I would hand Solzhenitsyn before, I won't go into other specifics. The man looms in his greatness. And part of that greatness is an understanding of where we are and what's going on. There is no priest who could not become a better priest by reading the Gulag Archipelago. If there are things in there that are not, again, he's an Orthodox. Well, you can sort that out in an instant. But God gave that man enormous talent for a purpose. And there are lessons to be learned there that are hugely important lessons. I believe it to be the great book of the century. Every age has one book that defines it. For the Middle Ages, it's Dante's Divine Comedy. For Rome, it was Virgil's Aeneid. For us, it's Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. Mass murder, suffering, barbarism, horror. And in the midst of that, the man found God. While Jean-Paul Sartre sat on his cafe on the West Bank, sipping cappuccinos and supporting the communists. And declaring himself an atheist, Right, right there is an extraordinary lesson. The time can be well spent. Much of this, I think, is a matter of discernment. Is simply discernment. What is appropriate for which audience? What do I read given the fact I have very little time to read? Having read it and not understood it necessarily, where do I turn to get a better understanding? Because there obviously is something here. There is meat here. There is meat here that can strengthen me. How do I do it? And I think it's a matter of discernment. I can't give you one answer overall. But I will say this for those of you who are teaching, Shakespeare, 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 Shakespeare for those young people. The best guide. I'll explain that more later. I'll explain the reasons why later. Any other questions?
Just about your point on the cinema, and you mentioned that it's maybe a form of art. How would you defend that against the criticism of cinema as a means of communication? Artificial mind.
I don't like it. It's secondary, and yet I was raised on it. Those of us who have been raised in the world, even as we try to struggle and free ourselves from it, still have a kind of attachment. I agree totally. The screens should all be gone. I would help build the pile of the movie screens and the TV screens and the computer screens. But you again have to understand the difficulty that if you're in the world, living in the world, there are two things. The fact that they're everywhere. I'll tell you, for me, I can't read in airports anymore. You fly a lot. CNN airport news drives me crazy. Crazy. I used to get a lot of reading done in airports. I can't because that thing is just glaring and you can't hide from it. Unless you go into the restroom and hide in there and try to read. You simply cannot avoid that thing anymore. It's everywhere. It's going to be there. If I were to walk into my classroom and begin class by saying, only the written word is worth your time, don't go to movies, I would have no authority. I would discredit myself instantly. Therefore, I play a little game with them. I hate it. Well, don't you ever go, oh yeah, I go, I've seen this. Oh, would you like it? You know, and suddenly I'm in a... And then there are things where, have you seen this? No, I wouldn't go to that if it would cure cancer. You know, I will not attend that. Well, why not? But you went to that, yes. And again, it's a matter of drawing distinctions, of trying to draw distinctions for them. And it turns into a kind of guessing game for them. You know, will he love this? I had a class that forced me. I mean, forced me. I spent months battling it to go see that new Romeo and Juliet that was out about 2 years ago. I said, I'm not going. I know I will. Oh, no, you got to go see it. Oh, Doc, you got to go see it. And finally, at the end of the semester, I said, I will go. Okay. But I won't guarantee that I will stay. Because one thing I do now, I buy the biggest popcorn. When the popcorn's gone, I often leave the theater. Very often, the popcorn's become my excuse for going. So I said to them, I will stay as long as the popcorn lasts, but I won't guarantee you I'll stay till the end. So, of course, they were all excited. And I come back to the next class, and it's like, what do you think? What do you think? And I said, and I mean this, it's the greatest Romeo and Juliet I've ever seen. And they were like, oh. We didn't think it was that good. So all of a sudden, I was able to explain to them what they had seen. They had no clue. And I will get into some of that. You know, point being, in many ways, you have a different obligation than I do. It seems to me in some ways it's essential for you to be more hardline. The films out there now are dreadful. I'm going to speak about one of them in connection with Romeo and Juliet. The films are dreadful. You have to discourage them from attending. They will still attend. It's going to happen. It's the apple out there in the garden luring them. And they're going to attend. And again, it's a matter of, especially the younger ones. It's a way of connecting with their peers. And it's just a monstrous problem. You know, point being, how do you educate them so they can know what is good and what is junk? How they can have some understanding of how they are being manipulated and how their souls are being threatened. Or how they are simply being entertained. And again, it's a matter of teaching them because they're going to watch some of this stuff, I fear. It's going to happen. I don't go much anymore, but I do go occasionally. And occasionally I'm surprised and delighted, but most of the time I just finish my popcorn and leave. But that says something about the state of the cinema when the popcorn is much more entertaining than the film. But I would say this. I think I'm going to give a talk on cinema sometime soon. I'm sorting out my own. I will say this. It is a second-rate art form. And, oh, my students get annoyed when I tell them that. It's a second-rate art form. There have been genuine talents who have worked in that medium in our time. But, at their best and at their greatest, they can't come close to accomplishing what first-rate artists have accomplished. And my argument for that is very simple. we could, by the end of the week, put on our own little production of Twelfth Night here. We could cast it, I could direct it, we could do a little production of Twelfth Night. But if you pull the plug, there's no more cinema. Cinema is totally dependent on technology. And the minute the power goes out, and as we all know, very soon the power is going out, there will be no more cinema. It's gone. And you can sit there with the boxes of film and sort of try to look at them under sunlight, but it's not going to do anything. And the fact of the matter is, any art form that is dependent on mechanics cannot really be, you have a dependent art form. You have a dependent art form. A playwright is not dependent on mechanics. He's dependent on some bodies that will pick up the script and start acting. And that's entirely different. What does that mean? That means the word and the action are primary. What is primary in the cinema? The projector. Even more, the power source, the outlet, the plug-in. It's the same thing with computers. The World Wide Web, all this information at our fingertips. Yeah, until the power goes out. And then and my other question is, what, right now, the local school board in Eau Claire is, they haven't been providing books. I mean, there aren't textbooks in the schools. That may be a good thing given the status of most textbooks now. But anyway, they're asking for $8 to $15 million in new computers. And I say, what earthly good are those if the students still can't read or write when they sit down in front of them? And they're not going to learn to read and write when they're sitting in front of them. You know what they do when they get online. Oh yes, I am going to go to the Dante website. You know what they're looking at until they see the teacher just wanders around now, checking screens. Oh, here she comes. Oh, click on to math exercises. It's absolutely farcical. It's just farcical. But again, what good is that going to do when the power goes out? It will do no good. What can we do? We'll pile them up and burn them to try to keep warm. It's all going to be gone. And I sincerely believe one of the great gifts that God can give us now will be to shut off the power. The total dependency of mankind on the machine will end in an instant. And it will be turbulent and there will be upheaval and people will go crazy, but I say I look forward to it. I'm as spoiled as the rest. What do you mean my beer won't be cold? I'm as spoiled as the rest. And instead of listening to Glenn Gould play Bach on my little CD player, I'll have to sit down at the piano and just, ask Bach's apology and hammer it out myself. It will be good for me. And I'll be under blankets much of the time. Fortunately, I carry some insulation. Other of you will need more blankets. It will be a total readjustment, but all for the good. I can still put on a little production of As You Like It, even when the power goes out. And in fact, more likely to do so. And it is a point of Solzhenitsyn's in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. You may have been unjustly sentenced. You may be in the camps. You may be working from 5 in the morning till 10 at night, subsisting on snow soup. But it's still life. And the basic moral questions have not changed. This is life. Even after the power goes out, and even if there's chaos, and even if, that's still life. And the basics will remain. They will all still be there. It will simply become much clearer, much faster. And when it does, I'm going to hold on to this book, again. I read a new biography of Solzhenitsyn. Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said, as a man grows older, he needs fewer books. That is absolutely true. And I find mine are being pared down and pared down. I always play the little game, you know, how if you could only take 5 books to your desert island, what would they be? And I'm going to play that game. As you grow older, you come to inhabit that desert island. You spend your time. You don't need as many books. I could get by very comfortably with 5 or 6. Because I tend to read the same ones over and over. And the old joke of, you know, what do you take? Well, you take your Bible and you take your Shakespeare is absolutely true. There are some who would take the Bible and Dante. If you've got 3 books, then you take the Bible, Dante, and Shakespeare. You know, that's... if I got 4 books, I'd take Don Quixote. And if I got 5 books, I'd take Bride, Set, or Busy. I'd be quite happy with those books. Be quite content. It's a lifetime's wisdom. And if it's one, you just take Scripture. It's easy enough. And I even have a little Douay-Rheims I found in a used bookstore. I mean, this thing, gracious. You know, it's about the only exercise I get carrying this back and forth to class. I've got a nice, light little Douay-Rheims that I can fit right in my pocket. So, I will see you tonight.